Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I saw a headline today that said, markets in turmoil. Actually, the markets were just down. It's the economy that's in a bit of turmoil. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Glad you could be with us on this Wednesday. It is the 11th of August today, and we begin with international trade, our trade specifically, and how much more stuff we're buying from overseas than we are sending abroad. The actual statistic, in case you're curious, is $49.9 billion more stuff, the biggest our trade gap has been in almost 2 years. But here's the thing. If the economy is weak, and the Fed basically said yesterday that it still is, why are we importing so much? We sent Marketplace's Scott Tong to check it out.
Maybe retailers are stocking up for a fall harvest. The $5 billion in additional stuff coming from overseas includes TVs, shoes, clothing, largely from China. Catherine Mann teaches economics at Brandeis University.
Businesses that are serving the consumer at the mall do think that the consumer is going to come back and that retail sales will be stronger in the fall. They'd be buying now for the fall sales.
What was that? Consumers could be back, despite the job market, despite the credit market, to help push this economy? That would help some of the chief pushers, manufacturers. They saw a tough June. Exports fell more than $2 billion. Economist Michael Hansen at Bank of America Merrill Lynch says overseas customers in places like Europe and China bought less of almost everything America sells.
Semiconductors, computers, telecoms, industrial supplies. It's kind of broad-based, and so that does suggest that it's in part some weakness abroad.
Do the math, and weak exports and strong imports equals hefty trade deficit. That'll drag on America's key economic yardstick, GDP. Still, it's just 1 month's number, and many expect the crucial export sector to bounce back. Why? The dollar could weaken, making U.S. exports cheaper overseas. It's tricky, but Michael Gapin at Barclays Capital says the Fed has signaled it may pump more dollars into the system, which would send the value of the currency lower.
If you believe yesterday's action has started the Fed in motion, you can make a case for a weaker dollar going forward that would be supportive of the export sector.
That is, if our friends overseas feel confident enough to buy. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I guess it took Wall Street a day or so to fully absorb the mean things the Fed said yesterday about the economy, because sell was the word of the day in stocks today. The gory details in due time, of course. But back for a second to what the Fed did say yesterday. It's not going to add more money to the economy. It is, though, going to reinvest the cash it put in during the financial crisis toward buying government debt and helping push interest rates lower. That money is supposed to help banks shore up their balance sheets and at the same time somehow encourage them to lend more. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Bankers say they're in a tough spot. They're being told to hold lots of money in the reserves in case things go south. They're also being told to lend more money to encourage the economy. But they're also supposed to be very careful about whom they lend to.
We, as your regulators, really encourage you to go out and make loans as long as they're prudent.
Karen Petru is a banking analyst at Federal Financial Analytics. She says the problem is with that word prudent. For years, the banks took on more risk. Then the financial crisis came. And now banks don't know what prudent's supposed to mean. Petru says the regulators' guidance isn't helping.
And here are some things that make them prudent, but then there are some other things that might not, at which point the banks look at those statements and scratch their heads and say, okay, now what do I know?
What they say they know is that there aren't any borrowers. The potential borrowers, both regular people and companies, are just too anxious to take on more debt, and that you can't force people to borrow. The housing market's a good example. Mortgage rates are ridiculously low. There have been all kinds of tax credits and buyer incentives, but nobody's taking out loans to buy houses.
And nothing a bank can or frankly should do can make them until the macro economy recovers and people feel better about their job prospects and their neighborhoods and all the other criteria that drive getting a home purchase mortgage.
There is one way to make people borrow. Make them an offer that's so good it overcomes their anxiety. Gerard Cassidy follows banks for RBC Capital Markets. He says we probably don't want to go there.
Imagine that. If you really want to go out there and lend today, it's very easy to create loan demand. You just need to lower your lending standards.
And we all know what the consequences of lowering our standards can be. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Agitated as today's equity markets were, there is more out there that gets traded than just stocks, you know. Gold prices gave back a little bit today, but they have been on a tear the past month or so. Marketplace's Patty Hirsch explains.
People are worried about the global economy. They think gold is the safest investment, so that's where they put their money. I'm Patty Hirsch from Marketplace.
What? Wait, already? All right, okay. So gold, I guess, is a safe bet for now. The outlook on another key commodity isn't quite so sunny, though. Crude oil futures went the way of equities today. Marketplace's Lisa Tucker tells us why.
Demand is way down for oil. That's because some economies are shaky and countries aren't using as much. I'm Lisa Tucker for Marketplace.
Man, again? All right, well, whatever, I guess. Oil's not looking so hot, and the same could be said about new mortgage applications. The numbers were flat for last week, despite some record low interest rates. Marketplace's Ethan Lindsay has that story.
People are still scared about the economy, so no one wants to blow their savings on a house. I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace.
You know, it's funny. Our news spots are usually a whole lot longer than that. I'm not really sure what happened on those. Anyway, on Wall Street today, we can only wish the session were shorter. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Someday, the recession is actually going to end. There won't be any more talk of double dips and extending unemployment benefits. And then everything's going to be okay, isn't it? Commentator Robert Reich worries that it isn't.
Most analysts are now predicting years of high unemployment. Even if the pace of job creation were suddenly to match the best years of the 1990s boom, and that would be nothing short of a miracle, we wouldn't be back to pre-recession levels of employment until 2015. And because most families are dependent on two wage earners, the insecurity is double. One consequence of a prolonged jobs recession could be an even longer one. Families living with job losses or fear of them adapt by permanently reducing household budgets. This lowers the demand for goods and services overall, and firms respond by permanently reducing payrolls. The second consequence is more subtle but at least as dangerous. Widespread and long-term economic insecurity fuels anger. You can already see it in the backlash against globalization. Polls show most Americans don't want more trade, which is why the president can't get Congress to ratify any new trade agreements. Many people are also angry about immigration. Some even propose denying citizenship to children born in the United States of parents here illegally. The anger focuses on every major institution. According to polls, the public has a record low opinion of government, and also of big business and Wall Street. Incumbent politicians of both parties face strong primary challengers from the right and the left. The biggest grassroots movement of all might be called mad-as-hell populism, fiercely anti-establishment and ready to believe the worst. Talk radio and the blogosphere have become cauldrons of rage. Sometimes in American history, anger has led to changes long overdue. Civil rights, for example, and more equal opportunity. But anger has also had the opposite effect, creating fodder for demagogues who use it to blame people or groups who aren't responsible but are easy scapegoats. In other words, the challenge ahead is not just to mend an economy that's been badly injured by the Great Recession and its aftermath, but to mend a nation that's become more fearful and polarized than at any time in a generation.
Once upon a time, Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. He is now a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Next week in this spot from the other side of the commentary aisle, Glenn Hubbard. Take a minute to send along your thoughts, wouldn't you? Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Last night was primary night in a lot of states. Out here in California, though, we are well into general election season. Yesterday, we told you about former eBay CEO Meg Whitman and how she's trying to become the governor of California. A big part of her strategy is sheer financial firepower. She has spent $100 million so far. Her Democratic opponent, Jerry Brown, hasn't. Brown served two terms as governor back in the 1970s. He is now the state attorney general, and his campaign has spent less than $1 million. April Demboski reports Brown does seem to relish that spending gap.
One of the things Jerry Brown is best known for is the blue Plymouth Satellite he drove when he was governor of California. He snubbed the chauffeured limousine and refused to live in the governor's mansion. Brown says his thrift dates back to his days in a Jesuit seminary.
And I spent many, many hours studying about the virtue of poverty.
Brown is no pauper. He has investments and lives in a $1.8 million house in the Oakland Hills. But his pockets aren't nearly as deep as Whitman's. His campaign is headquartered in a former box company warehouse in Oakland. Makeshift plastic desks line the walls. The sign in the kitchen beckons staff to take turns bringing in coffee. The day I visited, the phones weren't working. In the face of his opponent's wealth, Brown is turning his penny-pinching into a campaign message.
The word frugality is not something we hear anymore.
In some ways, Brown has little choice but to make a virtue of his thrift. He doesn't have the money to match Whitman's spending on advertising. His most recent financial disclosure shows his campaign has $23 million, about half of what Whitman has already spent on TV, radio, and internet ads. Brown devotes about a third of his campaign time to fundraising. Much of the rest of the time, he's giving interviews and trying to score free media at rallies and other events. He also gets news coverage in his role as attorney general. Recent polls have the candidates running about even.
Jerry Brown is reacting rather than proacting.
Alan Hoffenblum publishes a guide to California elections and has consulted for Republican candidates.
He's reacting to the Meg Whitman campaign. He's reacting to news reports that he, you know, hasn't put together a good message. He's reacting to Democratic activists as, when are you going to get your act together?
Those activists would mainly be labor unions, who see Whitman's agenda mostly focused on the wealthy. Brown isn't planning to start his campaign in earnest until after Labor Day. He doesn't want to risk running out of money in the critical weeks before the November 2nd election. In the meantime, the unions are trying to counter Whitman's barrage of radio and TV spots with ads on Brown's behalf.
Meg Whitman's never let the truth or the rules get in the way of helping herself.
So far, Brown's allies have spent about $8 million, but they're relying even more on their manpower. Rebecca Greenberg is with the California Labor Federation. It represents more than 2 million union members in private and public sector jobs.
We will be outspent. We will be outspent maybe by 5-1, but we will not be out-organized. We've got the boots on the ground.
Last week, the group teamed up with a local union of engineers in downtown Oakland.
Quick information from the union about Meg Whitman.
Six organizers handed out scores of flyers to other unionized workers getting off their shift. UC San Diego political science professor Thad Kauser is an expert on California politics. He says the union's one-on-one strategy has a record of success.
That works a lot better than an anonymous phone bank with a robocall urging you to turn out to vote.
But the problem with California, he said, is the state is just too big to knock on everyone's door.
We have to have wholesale rather than retail politics in California. And so if you want to reach 10 million voters, you're going to do that much more effectively with television commercials than you are with even the best organized set of ground troops.
Brown isn't planning to air his first campaign ads until the second week of September.
There is the old story of the tortoise and the hare. And the hare jumps around almost like a 30-second spot. But at the end of the day, it's the tortoise that gets across the finish line.
Of course, that's because the hare takes a nap in the middle of the race. Whitman has millions more to spend, and Brown shouldn't expect her campaign to rest anytime before Election Day. In Oakland, California, I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
Coming up, if you really, really want to be green.
The body is placed in a container with water and alkaline, and under pressure, the body dissolves.
One last low-carbon footprint, but first, let's do the numbers. Take the Fed's acknowledgement that the economic recovery is slowing at an unexpectedly high trade deficit, and you get the wah-wah trombones. The Dow Industrials fell 265 points today, 2.5% on the blue chips, finished at 10,378. The Nasdaq knocked off 68 points, 3%, closed at 2208. The S&P 500 dropped 31 points, 2.8%, ended things at 1089, 1089. Wells Fargo galloped down 5%. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase each lost more than 3.5%. Bank of America and Goldman Sachs were down 3% apiece. The price of crude oil leaked 3%, as Lisa Tucker told you, down to $78 a barrel, largely on news that China's economic growth is slipping. Macy's was the rare winner today, up nearly 6% after great sales numbers. More on that a bit later in the program. Gap fell 2%. Analysts said the clothing chain is having trouble holding on to its customers, which reminds me, I need a new pair of khakis. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. American Public Media presents Marketplace Minute, supported by Yellow Book 360. Tune in every Friday for Bill Radke's poetic take on the week's news in 60 seconds, available at marketplace.org. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the U.S. Department of Education concludes its first summit on bullying. Realty Track, an online site listing foreclosure data, releases its monthly U.S. foreclosure market report for July. And remember LPs? How about 45s? In some circles, tomorrow is Vinyl Record Day to preserve the cultural influences, the recordings, and the cover art of vinyl. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A bit later this week, we're going to get July sales numbers from the big retail stores, Friday to be specific, and everybody is going to be looking for clues to how the back-to-school shopping season is going to go. Consumers have been generally thrifty so far, but there was a sign today that things might be loosening up just a bit. Macy's announced second-quarter profits that went through the roof. Marketplace's Adrian Hill went to find out why and to find out what retailers are doing to get customers in the door.
There's one word that describes retailers these days.
Nervous.
That's analyst Wendy Liebman from WSL Strategic Retail. She says there's a real sense of uncertainty about the economy, about what's next. Shoppers are on edge, and retailers are doing all they can to ease their anxiety and get them into the store. Early sales figures point to a slow back-to-school season. Liebman says the retailer's first strategy is the deep markdown.
If you don't have a really good price, and or your customers don't think it's a really good price, they're just not even showing up.
But a big bargain isn't enough anymore. Department stores like JCPenney's and Dillard's have been struggling. So retailers are looking for other ways to stand out. They're tailoring their products to local shoppers. Macy's spokesman Jim Slezewski explains.
In Chicago, for example, we find that there is a much higher demand and preference for large sizes in women's shoes, a size 11, for example.
Macy's doesn't know why there are more big-footed women in Chicago, but it's stocking and displaying more big-size shoes in its store there. Macy's also has launched exclusive brands, including a line inspired by Madonna called Material Girl. And it holds events around the country, flower shows, parades, something called Glamorama, billed as a night of fashion, fantasy, music, and magic. Slezewski says all these things help keep Macy's on shoppers' minds.
We don't necessarily need any consumer to spend more, but we would like them to spend more of what they spend at Macy's.
In this economy, that may be as much as any retailer can hope for. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Millions of dollars worth of diamonds went on sale in Zimbabwe today. A group set up to prevent the trafficking of what are called conflict diamonds said the gemstones sold today met their standards. But human rights groups say that, in fact, the diamonds were mined in an area where government soldiers killed hundreds of people and forced children into hard labor. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now on a story that does have some graphic details.
The diamonds sold today come from Zimbabwe's Marange diamond fields. Civilians started mining them in 2008. The government sent the army in to stop them. Government officials deny any abuses, but human rights activists like John Elliott of Human Rights Watch say the soldiers were brutal.
Yeah, we've had stories of women being raped or sexually abused, or in some cases having parts of their bodies cut open when it's been suspected they've swallowed a diamond in a pouch.
The organization that certified Zimbabwe's diamonds as conflict-free is called the Kimberley Process. It's a group of mining industry representatives, human rights groups, and countries involved in the diamond business. It was formed in 2003 to stop Africa's diamond wars. But the Kimberley Process says nothing about blood diamonds, where there's bloodshed without war, like in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe squeaked through this loophole. Nadim Kara is with the human rights group Partnership Africa Canada. He's going to try to close the loophole.
So, wish us luck.
He'll need all the luck he can get. Every country involved in the Kimberley process will have to agree to close the loophole. But diamond exporters do want the Kimberley process certification because diamonds without it are worth less.
So a diamond worth 10,000 is all of a sudden you're getting 7 or 5,000.
Ian Smiley used to work for Partnership Africa Canada. He helped set up the Kimberley process, but he quit in disgust when he realized it didn't prevent producers from selling blood diamonds.
The only thing that will help some of them to wake up is if consumers start to tell retailers that they don't want diamonds unless they know for sure that they're clean.
After all, Smiley says, diamonds are supposed to represent love. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Cutting carbon emissions, greenhouse gases, has become a goal that reaches into every corner of life. And now it seems death. Six states in this country have approved a new low-carbon way to dispose of human remains. Resumation, it's called, and it's being offered as an alternative to cremation, reducing the body to a mixture of liquids and minerals. Now a group of funeral directors in northern Belgium wants to bring that technology to the European market, as Stephen Beard reports from Antwerp.
In the pleasant, prosperous suburb of Brussard, undertaker Bruno Kierenen lets me into his funeral home for a guided tour. Briefly shedding his doleful air, Bruno enthusiastically shows off the ceremony hall, a reception chamber, and the family viewing rooms.
I think this one is empty, yes. So the body is kept in this refrigerated coffin with a glass top.
Bruno is one of the city's busiest funeral directors. 140 cremations a year, 100 burials. Now he would like to offer his clients what he calls a third exit. He wants the authorities to approve resumation.
The body is placed in a container with water and alkaline, and under pressure the body dissolves. So there is a lot less energy necessary, and there is no carbon exhaust or no dust.
The process was developed by a Scottish firm with zero carbon emissions and using seven times less energy than cremation. This, says Bruno, would make for the greenest of funerals, and it shouldn't upset the neighbours.
People don't like to have chimneys in their backyard, so with resomation you don't have that problem. It's very natural and it's more eco-friendly.
But the process seems to be meeting some stiff resistance here in Antwerp. The bell of the Roman Catholic Cathedral tolls funereally across the city. Some traditional Catholics object to resumation through religious feeling, but many people recoil from it for other reasons. Resumation produces a kind of powder which can be tastefully placed in an urn and given to the bereaved, but it also leaves a fluid, and that, it has been suggested, might be washed down the drain. That doesn't go down well on the streets of Antwerp.
Into the sewers? Yeah. Oh, no, that cannot be.
You wouldn't approve of that?
No.
I'm for cremation. I think it's better, it's faster, it's cleaner.
I don't like it, it's not so, no. Not to be dissolved in a liquid or something like that. No, I don't see it as a good solution.
Advocates of resumation say the liquid remains contain no DNA, and therefore there's no disrespect, however it's disposed of. But Flanders still seems unlikely to become an early adopter for economic reasons. Funeral services like this are handled by funeral homes, but it's the regional government in Flanders that carries out all cremations. The government took control of the sector 5 years ago, and, says Belgium's leading undertaker, Johan Dexters, it has good reason to stand in the way of this technological progress.
I don't think the Belgian or the Flanders government will be ready today to accept new procedures, because they have already invested so much in new crematoria.
He says the Flanders government will fight to preserve its monopoly. It's likely the first resumations will happen in the United States. In Antwerp, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, a good rumor for the stock traders among you. There are reports today that General Motors is all but set to go public again, filing for its IPO perhaps as soon as Friday. GM's not talking. The White House, holder of 61% of General Motors shares, whenever it does decide to file, also isn't talking. The company reports what is expected to be its second straight profitable quarter tomorrow. And for today, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 265 points. That is 2.5%. The NASDAQ knocked off 68 points, 3%. The S&P 500 dropped 31 points, 2.8%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast, a meatpacking plant asks one kind of simple question.
Can you run a packing plant in rural America on only legal labor?
All right, not so simple. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.